just happened to check my email this evening, and I had two emails that came today from people who had been with us this morning through the streaming on our website. One was in Africa. Another is a former member here who now is confined at home. And both of them had some really good things and encouraging things to say about the fact that they can go online and participate with us in our assembly. And Miss Violet Weeks, one of the ladies, said that she saw the back of your head and she started crying thinking about you. And so I'll tell you who that was afterward, all right? But I thought that was really neat. Allows people who have been a part of our family to come back and visit even when they're unable to make that trip. We want to encourage you to stay following our dismissal this evening for a report on the Zambia medical mission in Namuyanga. And I've said that because I just like to say that word. Patricia and Rebecca Osborne will have a presentation for us, and there may be some of you who would like to participate in that this next year coming up. So I want to encourage you to stay. One more thing. When you're walking on the parking lot right out here and kind of in this corner over here to the right, my wife, when we walk in the morning, she's always telling me to look up. I'm looking on the ground for some reason ahead of me. And by the way, I found 3 pennies at different times this week. So I'm making money, you know. And she keeps telling me to look up. But if you will look down when you're out here, it seems that we had somebody, perhaps, that found a bucket of nails and they scattered them out. And we think we've got them all up. But just be watching for them. They're pretty long. So be watching for them. If you see them, pick them up. We had someone that had a flat this morning and had several of those nails in one tire. So just be watching, if you would, just kind of in that area right over here. We're going to continue with what I began last Sunday night. Somebody was talking to me this morning, telling me that they appreciated the lesson. And I made the comment that the lessons on Sunday morning are kind of in line with lessons that you would have heard in a Church of Christ 40 years ago. And she looked at me and smiled and said, "But I wasn't here 40 years ago." Not meaning here, but alive. We are looking at, I want to continue some thoughts about discouragement, because it's something that all of us, anyone who tries to accomplish anything in life, is going to have to deal with, maybe on multiple occasions in our life. There are lots of things that cause discouragement. I defined it last week as losing our courage and ability to resolutely face life. And we become discouraged when we lose our courage. And that's a pretty technical definition, I guess. To be discouraged is to lose your courage, and you're not able to deal with the things that happen in life. Everything takes you down whenever you're discouraged. It comes at an incredibly wide range of variety in our lives at different times for different purposes. We've all experienced discouragement, particularly if there's anything that we've ever undertaken to accomplish that's going to take a prolonged period of time. Then when you set your sights on something in the distance that's worthwhile, then very likely plan A is not going to work, and plan B and C and D, and you just keep on until, I believe that's one of the ways that the Lord has of guiding us, is putting obstacles sometimes in our path. And so it would really be a shame if God's trying to adjust our path and we just get discouraged and say, "Well, I quit." And so quite often in our life, I'm persuaded that difficulties come because the Lord wants to set our sights in a little bit different direction than perhaps we've had them in our life. And so we're forced to make adjustments. And I like little short, pithy statements. Sometimes whenever I'm working on a lesson, on particularly a topical lesson, then I will Google statements about that topic and just read little statements that people have made over the years. And I read through them pretty quickly because I like the short ones. And I like when I find one that kind of strikes my fancy, I like to think about, well, is this true? Is it true part of the time? Is it true all of the time? And to just think about some of those. And so one of the ones that I Googled on discouragement and came up with was one of those anonymous ones. Almost all of them have someone that claimed it. But this one was anonymous, and it said, seeds of discouragement will not grow in a thankful heart. And I think that's true. And we could probably restate that and turn it around and talk about, you know, when we are thankful, then we're not going to get discouraged. When we get to the point that we're not thankful for the things in our life, we're an easy target to get discouraged. And I think that's very true. And so if you don't want to be discouraged, then one of the things you probably need to do is practice being thankful. When you get up in the morning, even if you have difficulties, and who doesn't? Then make a mental note to yourself to think of some things that you're thankful for in your life. I mean, most of us that got up this morning and got outside, we were thankful that it was really cool. This is an unusual September for us in this area, isn't it? And so that's something to be thankful for. And it doesn't have to be this great thing. Just list some things in your life that you have to be thankful for. And you will not be as easy to be a prey to discouragement. Let me give you another definition of discouragement. We operated off of that one about losing your courage and unable to resolutely face life last time. But let me give you what I've tried to think of how I would define this definition differently than the other one. And so I came up with this. I think this is kind of a diagnostic definition, and it'll help us understand discouragement in relationship to our spiritual life. And so here's another definition for you. And I like this one, by the way. I don't know where I got it, so I'll claim it as original, all right? Discouragement is when your negative emotions, such as fear, anger, and frustration, overpower your faith. Discouragement. It's when your negative emotions overpower your faith. And so I want to look at some examples, some biblical examples of discouragement. And if we were to take a poll, then I suspect that those of us that are familiar with our Bibles, probably the greatest percentage of folks about discouragement would go to Elijah. And that's whenever people think about and give lessons on discouragement, that's usually the number one person that they go to. In 1 Kings chapter 19, we find him in a cave. All alone. He's alone because he wants to be alone. Not untypical of people who are discouraged, right? We tend, when we get discouraged, we tend to back ourselves up in the corner, close the door, turn the lights out, leave me alone. And so here was Elijah in the cave. Some 3.5 years earlier, he had prayed that it wouldn't rain in Israel, and God answered his prayer. And during that time, God had miraculously sustained Elijah every single day. Every day saw a miracle. The first part of that 3.5 year period of time, God sent ravens with bread and meat every morning to feed him. And think about this now. Think about how God is supplying what he needs to sustain him with a miracle every day. And then whenever the creek that he was living on ran dry, and he went somewhere else. And that tells me that even when God is sustaining us, that it doesn't mean that everything is going to go smoothly. Could God have kept some water in a pocket somewhere there for him to stay on that creek for the whole time? Sure, he could have. But God let the creek run dry, so he didn't have any water. So God sent him to a widow's house, and he lived there every day, being supplied miraculously by God. You remember that God caused the widow's oil and her flour bin to not go dry. And so every day when that widow went and opened up that flour bin, there was some more flour in there. I'd like to have seen, you know, if it was completely full or if it was half full or how. I would have been one of those people that kept it open, tried to stay open all night to see when God added it to it, you know, to see just exactly how this took place. But it took place. He also, during that period of time, had one of the most incredible miracles in the whole Old Testament. And that is, he brought the widow's son back to life. You remember? A resurrection occurred. A dead boy was brought back to life. And then God speaks directly to him. Have you ever been in a situation in your life where you wish God would talk to you? Where God would you could communicate with God, you could ask him a few questions and he would answer those? Well, God spoke to him, talked to him. And he tells him to present himself to King Ahab. Now, that's not going to be the most congenial reunion that's ever taken place, because Ahab has been looking for him to take his life because he knows that he is the one responsible for this terrible drought that the country's going through. And the results of that meeting was that meeting on Mount Carmel. You remember the 450 Baal prophets? Actually, there were 400 more prophets. So there was actually 850 prophets that he confronted that day. And he was with a miracle, he was overcame all of those. And God provided one of the most notable demonstrations of his deity ever witnessed on Mount Carmel. And so I asked myself, how could Elijah, after 3.5 years, every single day, God has miraculously supplied what he needs. He has participated in a resurrection. He has just faced down 850 Baal prophets. With everything done with a miracle from God, how could he possibly have any doubts or any fears after experiencing God's miraculous hand in his life every single day for 3.5 years? How could he possibly be discouraged? Would you be? I think about the children of Israel. For 40 years, every single day, God miraculously supplied the things that they needed for life that day, didn't he? Every day. And how often were they discouraged? I mean, their clothes didn't wear out. And I suspect that there were some people who got tired of wearing the same clothes. Their shoes didn't wear out. I suspect there were some people who wanted a new pair of shoes. Don't you? And the food, we know that they griped about the food, even though it was the food of angels. They griped about it. They wanted some meat. God gave them meat, and then they griped about that. And problems came as a result of that. Why would he be so discouraged because of one single angry woman after all that had happened in his life? And it strikes me, and I'll have to say that sometimes I've experienced some of the same thing myself, that one of the most dangerous times for discouragement comes on the heels of accomplishing something that you've been working for some period of time, and it's accomplished. And if you're not careful, if you're not on your guard, then the next thing that will happen to you is you're discouraged. You've had this thing that you've been working toward, and all of your efforts have been concentrated toward the accomplishment of that goal, and God accomplishes that goal in your life. And the next thing you know, Maybe it's kind of like working toward retirement, guys and ladies, your whole life, and you've been looking forward to it. You know, it's just been your goal for the last 40 years, and then you get it, and it's real easy to become discouraged following that. And Elijah was tired. He was emotionally spent. He had been living under an incredible amount of pressure and stress for months and months on end. The enemy wouldn't go away. Nothing had changed. The criticism was still there, even after he had proven himself on Mount Carmel. And he was afraid. And his emotions overcame his faith. And he ran. And all he could think of was, I'm all alone. Nobody else is trying. Obadiah had told him earlier that he himself had 100 prophets that he personally was taking care of. But you know, when you're discouraged, you're not real open to facts, are you? You don't want to hear anything good, because you persuaded yourself that everything's bad. We're controlled by our feelings. And we don't want to hear somebody tell us, well, it could be worse. Or we don't want to hear somebody telling us, well, it's really not as bad as you think it is. We want people to tell us, yeah, it's really bad. It's really terrible. You're in the worst situation anybody could ever be in. So we can feel sorry for ourselves. You know that you have the Elijah syndrome when you hear that inner voice saying, I'm the only one who cares. Nobody else is doing anything. Nobody else is even trying. And so you know you have the Elijah syndrome. You know that discouragement has grabbed your heart and has a hold on you. And then there was Moses in Numbers 11, verse 11 through 15. He was discouraged because he had too much responsibility. People were griping about not having any variety on the menu. And he became angry and discouraged, and he asked the Lord, Numbers 11, beginning in verse 11, why have you brought this trouble on your servant? What have I done to displease you that you put the burden of all these people on me? Did I conceive all these people? Did I give them birth? Do you know people talk to God like that? Why do you tell me to carry them in my arms as a nurse carries an infant to the land you promised on oath to their fathers? Where can I get meat for all these people? They keep wailing to me, give us meat to eat. I cannot carry all these people by myself. The burden is too heavy for me. If this is how you're going to treat me, put me to death right now. If I found favor in your eyes, and do not let me face my own ruin. He can see no solution to this. It's an impossible problem. The people are demanding that they have meat. And he looks at the situation. He knows that there's no earthly way that it can happen. He said, if you were to take all the fish of the sea and you were to kill all the cattle, could you supply enough meat for these people? God said, is my hand so short? You think I can't handle this? But in his eyes, nothing is going to change. I'm facing an impossible situation, and there's not anything that anybody can do about it. And besides that, nobody cares anyway. So why don't you just go ahead and kill me? I'd rather die. And then there was Job. And I suppose if there was ever anybody that had a reason to be discouraged, maybe it was Job. Because I don't ever want to have to live through what Job did. Job chapter 3, verse 11 through 13. Why did I not perish at birth and die as I came from the womb? Why were there knees to receive me and breasts that I might be nursed? For now I would be lying down in peace. I would be asleep and at rest. He wanted to die at birth. And he wanted to die, I think, because he had lost all the loved ones in his life, except his wife. But 10 children in one day, how can your heart bear that? And everything that you have worked for your entire life, your 401k is gone. Nothing is there. You're down to zero. And you've worked all your life to build it up. Would you be discouraged? And then there was Jonah. And Jonah hated his job. And he was angry with God who gave him his job. Who was so discouraged that he was more concerned about a gourd vine than he was 120,000 people who had just responded to his last sermon. I never have preached that kind of sermon. 120,000 people responded. And he was angry. There wasn't anything that could happen that was going to get him over his mad. And he was discouraged. And he said, it would be better for me to die than to live. And God said, do you have a right to be angry about the vine after he had killed the gourd vine? You remember? And Jonah said, I do. I'm angry enough to die. You know you're discouraged when you're more concerned about a plant than you are the souls of men. And then there was Jeremiah, Jeremiah 20, verse 7 through 10. And Jeremiah didn't like his message. And I don't blame him one bit. Because God had told him at the very outset when he called him, nobody's going to listen to you. And they're going to try to kill you. But I'm going to make you like a brass pillar. They're not going to be able to kill you. They're going to try. But they're not going to listen to your message. But I want you to know that I want that message preached anyway. And he didn't have any friends. Nobody cared. And so he says, oh Lord, you deceived me. You overpowered me and prevailed. I'm ridiculed all day long. Everyone mocks me. The word of the Lord has brought me insult and reproach all day long. I hear many whispering, report him. Let's report him. All my friends are waiting for me to slip, he said. You get the point? If you feel discouraged, you're in good company. The greatest men that have ever lived have faced discouragement. Everyone, as a matter of fact, who ever tries to accomplish anything worthwhile, especially over a long period of time, has been discouraged. I had an older lady that crocheted a plaque for my office. I don't have it up in my office here because I keep thinking we're going to get another one, but that's another story. But the plaque says, most people can stay motivated for 2 or 3 months. A few people can stay motivated for 2 or 3 years. But a leader will stay motivated for as long as it takes to get the job done. And I like that. And I think that's true all the time. So let me give you one passage with two principles to remember when you face discouragement. Now, I'd recommend you write this one down. It's one you've seen before. You might not have made this exact application of it, but I think it'll take some of the pressure off your life when you're really feeling pressure. And the passage is 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 2 through 4. 1 Corinthians 4, verse 2 through 4. Now, to get a setting that we don't normally bring to this passage, one of the things that we know, Paul is writing this to the Corinthians. And among the many things that are happening in the church at Corinth was they were comparing preachers. And they were, this group was saying, well, so-and-so is the best preacher we've ever had. And this one was saying, no, so-and-so is the best preacher we ever had. And another group said, no. You know, this preacher, that he hasn't been here, but he's over there. He's the best preacher. And so in the face of all of that, and I don't know that that's what precipitated that, but here's what Paul will write. Now, it's required that those who have been given a trust must prove faithful. I care very little if I'm judged by you or any human court. Indeed, I do not even judge myself. My conscience is clear, but that does not make me innocent. It is the Lord who judges me. And so I want to draw two principles. Whenever you're feeling pressure in your life, I want you to go to that passage and jot it down somewhere in the margin of it so you can recall what it was. The first one is, you need to understand clearly what God wants from you. You need to know what your job description is. One of the things that I advise, sometimes I have preacher friends or young preachers who call me and they're trying out for a job and they've got some questions, something's come up and they've got some questions and they want some advice from some old white-headed preacher somewhere, you know, and so they call me. And one of the things that I recommend to them is that they get a job description. Now, it doesn't have to be in writing. If it has to be in writing, then there's probably a problem somewhere along the way. Now, that's not necessarily true in the business world, but it is, I think. It is true in the church. So, you need to clearly understand what God wants from you. And I get that from verse 2 where it says, now it is required that those who have been given a trust must prove faithful. And I know I've used this illustration before, but I can't help but use it again. I can't help myself here. There's a story of a young man who saw a sign in the window of a hardware store that said, help wanted. And there was a phone number on the sign, and so he called it, and the owner answered and said, the young boy said to him, I'm calling about the sign in your window advertising a job. I'd like to apply. And the store owner said, I'm sorry, son. That position was filled about a week ago, and I just forgot to take the sign down. And the young man continued. He said, sir, do you mind if I ask, are you pleased with the person that you hired? And the owner was caught a little bit aback, and he said, well, yes, I'm quite pleased. He's prompt, he's courteous, he's a hard worker. But if you don't mind, will you tell me why you asked that question? And the young boy replied, yes, sir. You see, I'm the boy you hired, and I just wanted to know how I was doing. I'm kind of that way, too, aren't you? I kind of like to know if I'm filling the bill, don't you? I like to know if I'm living up to expectations. And so, we all need to know how we're doing, don't we? I mean, I really want to know if I'm pleasing God or not. And you can never be sure until you know what's expected of you. And it has to be clear. It doesn't, you don't need some kind of a foggy, vague idea of what you're supposed to be doing. And I think that too many of us as Christians have a fog, vague idea of what we're supposed to be doing, and we never know if we're doing a very good job or not. And so we live about half discouraged most of the time. And then, to add on that, we let everybody else tell us what our job is, and we're going to always be frustrated and prone to discouragement. And so you need to know what God expects of you. And I want to help you know what your job is. For lots of years, as a preacher, I thought that I knew what my bottom line was. And that bottom line in my mind was, I want to be effective. That was my bottom line. That's what I called my bottom line. I want to be effective. And so I was always trying to gauge myself and say, well, am I being effective? And I'll have to tell you that there were lots of times in my life that I didn't feel very effective at all. And so I tended to be discouraged because I had made that my bottom line. And as long as I felt like that I was being effective and I felt like I could endure anything that came my way. But the problem was there was lots of times that I didn't feel very effective. Are you with me? You understand what I'm saying? Now the question that really we need to ask ourselves is, who determines effectiveness? Who determines whether or not you're effective? Who do you let determine whether or not you're? Was Noah effective? You think if you had asked him, he would have felt very effective preaching year after year after year, and not one single person positively responded to him? You think he felt effective? I suspect he didn't feel very effective during those years, don't you? Were the prophets effective? When nobody would listen and people were whispering about them, and people were even laying plots to take their lives, were they effective? You think they felt effective? Was Paul effective as he signed off on his last recorded epistle in 2 Timothy and he said, at my first offense, no one came to my support, but everyone deserted me. Do you get the feeling that he might have been a little bit down? Went to court, not one person. Not one person. In all that he had done for so many people, for his life, not one person came to his defense. They all left. Was Stephen effective in Acts chapter 6 and 7? His little speech cost him his life, didn't it? Was he effective? You understand what this passage is saying? It didn't say that a person that had been given a trust must prove effective. That's not what it says. And when that dawned on me, it helped me a great deal in my life. He said, for a person who's been given a trust, he wants you to be faithful. He wants you to be full of faith. He wants you to trust him. And whatever it is that he has asked you to do in your life, what he asks you to do in order to accomplish that is trust him. And he'll supply you every day everything you need to accomplish what he wants you to accomplish. If he doesn't, he lets you down. Sometimes the well may go dry, the creek may run dry. But that's because he wants you to go somewhere else. He wants you to experience something new in your life. Another way that God is going to supply your needs in your life. Your job is not to be effective. At least not by your standards or my standards. Your job is to be faithful. That's all God wants from you. To trust him enough to do whatever it is that he tells you to do. Philip, it reminds me of Philip that God had sent to Samaria, and he went to Samaria, and it took lots of courage to go to Samaria because the Jews weren't happy about somebody going to Samaria and Samaritans being saved. They didn't deserve to be saved. But Philip went to Samaria, and things were really, really going well. He had a great gospel meeting going. People were responding, just piling on over themselves. Responding to the gospel. And while all that's going on, God came to him and he said, I want you to go to a road that I'm going to show you, the Gaza road down there. I got somebody I want you to preach to. One person. And he left all of the things that were going on to go see one person, that Ethiopian. God's got some strange ways about him, doesn't he? God knows some stuff. You think there might have been something good that came from that Ethiopian becoming a Christian and going back to his home? We measure effectiveness by how people respond to us. God wants his pure message preached every generation to every creature under heaven. And his word will, like a magnet, pull from every nation those who will respond. And that's the way that we view it. It's not my business whether or not people respond. When you're faithful to his message in your words and in your life, you are effective in God's eyes. Regardless of how many people respond or how many people don't or how people respond to you, you're doing exactly what God wants you to do. Now, if you really understand that and accept that, that takes some pressure off your life. Knowing exactly what your job is and keeping that clearly in focus at all times. It's the single most important thing you'll ever do for yourself in your life. And it will keep you from becoming unnecessarily discouraged. And then the second principle from this same passage, and it's real simple, you're not the judge. Verse 3 and 4, I care very little if I am judged, number one, by you or any human court. Number two, indeed I do not even judge myself. Number three, it is the Lord who is the judge. We need to understand that. People are not saying good things about you. Well, what does that mean? It means that there are some people that are not saying good things about you. It doesn't necessarily mean anything about you. It may mean more about that person who said it than he does about you. And quite often, that's the truth. There's only one judge, and that spot is filled. God fills the executive, the legislative, and the judicial spots in the kingdom. And you know what that means? That means that you don't rule, you don't make laws, and you don't judge. That's his business. Now really, some of us feel like that we have some responsibility to do some of those things. And that takes pressure off in two areas. You don't have to measure up to everybody else's expectations, not even your own. Have you sometimes set expectations too high for yourself? Yeah, it can happen. And number two, you don't have to be the enforcer. And let me tell you why that's so important. Because, you see, if it's my job to judge and to enforce, then I'm responsible for the outcome. You think about it. And I'm just not that powerful, and I'm not that smart. And I can't always determine the outcome that I want to come out of a situation. I'm kind of like Jonah sometimes. I can't even see the good sometimes when it comes. If you have it within your power to make somebody to do something, to legislate them doing it and put them in a corner and make them do it, don't do it. And there's two reasons, probably more than that, but a couple come to mind. Number one is they'll resent it and you, whatever it is that you force them to do against their will. And number two, as soon as they can, they'll quit if you made them do it. One of the most heart-wrenching and yet informative scenes in Jesus' life, at least to me, is the story of the rich young ruler. And I say that because Mark chapter 10, verse 21 says that when that young man came to Jesus and he started talking to him, it said Jesus looked at him and loved him. It doesn't say that about any one other person in the whole Bible. Jesus looked at that young man. He saw all the potential that he had. He saw his tender heart. He saw how that he really wanted to please God. And he looked at that young man, the Bible says, and he loved him. And yet Jesus let him walk away. Could he have worded things in such a way that the young man wouldn't have walked away? You bet you he could have. But he knew he wouldn't be doing him any favor to water it down. He knew what his problem was. He brought his problem to make him confront it, and the young man couldn't handle it. He said, you got too much stuff. You got to get rid of it because it's your God. And as long as you have all that stuff, you can't really serve me with your whole heart, soul, mind, and strength. He didn't say all those things, but he knew those things. And it very well may be true that some of us have got too much stuff and it become our God. And the best thing that God could do for us is make us confront that. And then we have to make a decision. Do we trust him or do we trust our stuff? Is he more valuable to us than our stuff is? You see, it's not your job and it's not my job to make people respond in a certain way. You're not the enforcer and neither am I. Your job is to be faithful with your words and with your life. And then it matters very little what people say about you. Or even how you feel about yourself or your own effectiveness. You have to learn to let God determine that. In 1 John chapter 3, verse 19 and 20. This then is how we set our hearts at rest. Some versions say, this is how we set our hearts or quiet our fears in his presence. You ever, in your relationship to God, been really uneasy about how things are going between you and God? And you're kind of afraid that maybe you're not doing enough or maybe this is happening. He says, this is how we quiet our fears in the presence of God whenever our hearts condemn us. Here's what you got to know. For God is greater than our hearts, and he knows everything. God is greater than our hearts. When our hearts condemn us and we're trying to please God and we're listening to him and we're trying to respond to him and we just don't feel very effective. He says this is how we quiet our fears, our hearts. Our hearts are the seat of our emotions. This is how we quiet our fears, our anger, our disappointment, our discouragement in the presence of God. Remember this. God knows everything. He knows what's in your heart. And if you're trying to please God, that's the best news that there could be. If God judges on the outside, and it's only with the results, the external results that come, then we might have reason to be discouraged. But if God knows that more than anything else in my life, I want to please Him, I want to walk as close to Him as I possibly can. I'm listening to what He has to say to me by reading His Word. I'm trying to respond to that. He said, then, if you still have fears, if you still have concerns, this is how you quiet your fears, how you quiet your heart down. Remember this. God can look inside you, and He knows what's inside here. When you fail, He knows how you feel about that. Discouragement. It's a terrible thing. It's a dark, black thing. It robs us of the courage to face life. It overrides our faith if we allow it. And so our defense against it is faith is the victory that what? Overcomes the world, isn't it? While we stand and sing.